You're listening to author Sue Brain, and I'm delighted to welcome you back to this third series of Embracing Your Mortality. Yet again, I've got a great lineup of guests, all of whom put living consciously for a better world at the heart of what they do. The aim of this third series is to gather together leading thinkers, scientists, and sages to explore why engaging with our mortality matters. They include death doulas.
Everybody should have the opportunity to volunteer with people at end of life, because boy, does it change your perspective on how to live.
A Buddhist who works in Nepal.
I cannot think, you know, okay, when I'm 50 or 60, then I will start familiarizing myself with my mind. I don't know if I'm going to live till I'm 50 or 60.
Two extraordinary women determined to ease distress and fear at the end of life.
For me, the idea of dying and death was just so final. It really did terrify me in the middle of the night when I was lying there on my own.
And my final guest, truly an early Christmas special, is a world-leading expert in near-death experiences, end-of-life experiences, and consciousness.
We can be very self-centered, but if you're going to die, these things don't matter so much.
And if you haven't already, don't forget to listen to the first two series of Embracing Your Mortality. Links to my guests in both series can be found on my website, suebrain.co.uk. Even though we're going through increasingly challenging times, I hope all these conversations from all three series inspire you to embrace your mortality so you too can live more consciously for a better world. Angela Ward is the award-winning co-founder of the independent Go Simply Funerals and Riverside Funerals based in Wiltshire. Angela and her husband Kevin are passionate about providing personal care, support and guidance for families every step of the way. Angela loves to sing and is an established celebrant trainer.
What happens when we're in a society that values the self more than anything else, where your value, your worth it, becomes the sole sense of bookending of importance? And what that is then is that you lose that sense of creating ancestry. And I think it's one of the things which is what we're seeing in the funeral business right now. And it's because we've become too person-centered. Now, if all I have to offer is a small something, and I know that my life will end and my mortality is finite, then I have to have a legacy. I have to leave something. I have to, as you said, pass the baton.
Actually, that would be money or a house.
Yes.
And actually, yes. We won't really, a lot of us will not be doing that anymore, because that's run out. Right. So this is new. This is unprecedented, the times we're going through.
That's right. And I think this sense, we, you know, where we're losing this sense of connection to ancestry and place and our place in things and our sense of smallness in the present, because we are still connected to others and to a future that's not yet happened, that we can have a legacy in. Hmm. Here's a really tangible example of that. Over the last 10 days, we've had 8 funerals come in as a company. Every single one of those is a direct cremation. So that means that what the person wants is to just have a funeral with, which is just acting as a disposal of the body. Now, there will be no service. There is no sense of marking the life. Now, there's a variety of reasons for this. Number one is cost. Number two is that where a person doesn't see themselves as having, you know, they're a simple, humble human being. They say, well, what's the point in having a funeral? I mean, there's nothing much to say. There's nothing much to mourn. I just want something simple. I've, you know, just put me in a cardboard box and take me down to the crematorium. But what they're missing is why a funeral is important. Mm-hmm. And where a funeral has become so person-centered that all it is about the person, when the person says, look, don't worry about me. I'm not important enough to have a funeral for. But what a funeral does is place everybody in that room in time.
Yeah.
You are looking out back over a life, which is like looking at the past and looking at your place in the story. You're looking at the present in terms of, gosh, this person's died, I'm going to die. And you're asking yourself the bigger questions. Yeah. What's the meaning of my life? What will I leave behind? You know, what's it all about?
Do you not think that where we're going right now with, you'd have to be completely unconscious not to understand that massive changes are really facing us. And this is set against the backdrop of climate change and possible cataclysmic events happening because of that. Do you feel then that people are losing their, this is the way they deal with the fear and maybe even terror of not just of dying, but actually of human extinction?
Absolutely. I think that denial and delusion are huge parts of the human psyche. So, for example, I can do a funeral where the alcoholic person who's died, they just don't see it. Or, you know, gosh, you know, they loved a drink. Or, oh, isn't it funny he died of an aneurysm? You know, there is an automatic defense against the fear and the anxiety that is delusion and denial, and at its very very hardest, delusion. That's very human, to defend oneself against the chaos of the fear or the guilt or the rage.
What I also notice is the eulogy is literally eulogizing the person, even if they weren't very nice. And it's amazing how many people read about in the press and they've been an angel in their life. I don't think so. Why are we so afraid to say this person was a rounded person and they had their dark side and their light side? But it's almost like it is not right to speak badly or call the person who's died for who they truly were. And I'm really curious about that.
It's mostly because of the person that's died is a reflection of the people that are left. So they feel shame. And they can't do that shame publicly. For example, I did a funeral recently for a girl who died, who was a heroin addict. She'd had all her children fostered and adopted, and she was a nightmare. And her boyfriend, the same. He was also a heroin addict, on-off relationship, lost all their kids. Now, only five people came to that funeral. And it was her mother, her sister, her boyfriend, her son who'd been adopted, and the boyfriend's mother. Now, that heroin addiction was right out in the open. It was right there. It was really about the boyfriend in the room to say, you know, because she stood up and she said, this could have been you, could have been either one of you. It just happened to be her. There was no denial. And, you know, certainly me as a witness to that, I don't have any judgment to give on that. So there was the sense of shame was purged from that situation.
It was
deeply painful, and I think both mothers were there as mothers of addicts, crying for what they never had. I mean, you know, this is the thing when we take ritual out of our lives, when we take funerals, when we take these opportunities for being in part of the bigger picture, we take that opportunity away from the community. Not just, you know, a funeral is not just about the person that died. A big event is not just about the person that died. It's about an opportunity to step out of our small lives, to step into a bigger space, to access the big picture.
Well, it's to access the human condition.
And the condition of life, or God, or whatever it is.
You know,
is there a God, or isn't there a God? Or where are the opportunities for us to access the bigger picture? Now, when you take religion away, which is the most practical source, or the most accessible place that a person, even if they were a non-believer, would have gone to church on a Sunday, and they would have been a sermon about the bigger picture. every week, you know, everybody went, everybody heard something that took them away from their banal suffering human lives of, you know, scraping a living and living in a hovel or whatever it was. That spirituality and the music that went along with it and the words and the language gave them a moment to just step into the bigger picture. Now, when we have a lot of direct cremations and no funerals, that's another place where accessibility to the bigger questions is taken away. And if we don't access the bigger picture, we're going to stay mundane and we are not going to deal with the bigger picture, which is climate change or what life is all about.
Be able to walk up and face it and actually just and actually be kind of okay in the horror of it.
Yes.
In my experience of working with people who accept they're dying or they accept the family member is dying, they give themselves the gift of completely looking at life differently from a perspective of the truth. And those people that stay in denial, in my experience of them, absolutely close everything down, and they stop these massively important conversations happening and being able to connect with something greater, actually. And certainly in the people I've talked to about climate change, those people able to, you know, Jem Bendel and the work that he's done with deep adaptation just gives people the permission to really go into grief. And because of that, they can actually do something with themselves in whatever way they can. And there's no right or wrong way with this.
You've sat with people that can either, as you said, face the horror, and the people that don't. What do you notice is the difference in their conversations? Because this is that on a singular level. And I think
this is through the death cafes, actually running deep adaptation death cafes, talking about death and dying, set against the backdrop of cataclysmic climate change and being willing to embrace that. It's searing honesty, knowing that this isn't fixable, but within that context, do you know what? I could do this. I could do this for my family. I could do this for my community, or I could write about something, or maybe I can go on a march, but I need to feel that I am of use somehow within the context of what's happening, even though it is hopeless. But what, you know, we don't know that it's hopeless because we don't know how Gaia is going to respond to what's happening. We don't know.
I think people just want to go back. Actually, we can't go back. You know, we can't go back. And as I say, we are, you can call it the precipice, you can call it the paradox point. We are at that turning of the wave. The image of the crucifixion is a very powerful one, because where can you go when you are nailed on a cross?
Yeah.
The only place you can go in that kind of limit of freedom and that abasement of mortality is to turn within. This is what I mean about all the energies out. It's all out. It's all having, consuming, buying. But actually, you know, where we need to come is to turn that energy within, because the freedom is within. This, to me, is the worst part of what's happened, is that we are having those places to go taken away. Whether it's through over-secularization, whether it's through the arts being devalued in education, whether it's the opportunities for learning instruments are taken away from children because it's too expensive. We know that a people is a healthy people when they have access and outlets in arts and music.
Because it takes us beyond ourselves.
Because it takes us beyond our small selves to connect to something infinite. So where we need to look for our freedoms is not wearing masks or, you know, this distractive idea. It's about education in schools. It's about funding the arts. It's about having space for people to find their inner worlds and find freedom through that, to access something greater than the small self.
It's really strange, because actually even in my lifetime, being 68, the whole relationship with religion has completely fallen apart. When I was a young kid, we were expected to go to church. It wasn't a choice. And I sort of feel like there's such a peril in losing connection. I'm going to use the word religion loosely, because
I would too.
But this sort of sense of something greater than us, let's call it consciousness or spirituality these days.
Yes.
And there is such a peril of losing connection with that. And it's almost like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross used to talk about the fact that, you know, we were made of the four quadrants, which is the physical, obviously, the emotional, the mental, but also the spiritual. And if we can't, if we don't develop that, we're walking around like a three-legged table.
We are.
And we are. I think that's such a powerful metaphor for humanity now.
I do. And I think that obviously, you know, we're saying religion loosely, but where religion has become a personal business instead of a community or a social business, it's taken us away from our connection to our families and our tribes, because we're not worshipping together. We're not accessing a spiritual state together. And where that is now piling in is to nationalism, because instead of connecting to something bigger than yourself as a force for good, it's now becoming, I identify nationally, because people need to feel they belong to something bigger themselves. Yeah. You know, nationalism is on the rise everywhere. The far right is on the rise everywhere, because these are people that need to feel that they belong. To kind of bring it to where we are in the world of death right now, we have a bunch of direct cremations, which means that, you know, yet again, another opportunity for the family or the community or the tribe to come together at a particular moment to reflect on one's own place in things. Gosh, here we are. This is death. This is, you know, and all the questions that come with that, the lack of opportunity to share in community ritual or even just to sing together and have that moment out of time. To say, okay, that was the past, this is now, and what's our legacy in the future? What do we leave in the future? This person has left this legacy. And to mourn together, to experience that sense of the bigger picture and where it's become all about the self. Homo Deus, as Yuval says.
I've just been reading about Maslow, you know, Abraham Maslow. Yes. I loved his transpersonal teachings, because, you know, he says, you know, we come through carrying the DNA of our ancestry and our parents, and we come through carrying the DNA of the whole of the evolution of humanity since its time when whoever walked out of the cave in Africa, and we're carrying that within us, this massive story. Massive. And then we carry this unique something that, just, you know, you will not live my life and I will not live your life, because the only life I can live is my own, and nobody can ever live this life for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm blown away with that. When you think the 7 billion souls on this planet, every one of them having a completely unique experience to themselves. Mm-hmm. And then we try and put people into a group. We try and make them the same, or dress them the same, or address them the same. And of course, nobody is. But then I have no idea where all of this is going. But I think that sense of the sacred, the reverence of the awe of what this means.
To me, there's this sense of conquest. And what I've noticed over the last years is that we as a human species have kind of increased our sense of conquest. So, for example, space, the moon, Everest now. I mean, good God. I mean, that was a thing. That was a symbol of the unconquerable nature of the earth, that, you know, you could die. This is ourselves as small and nature as very powerful, even if we're not connecting to a god, you know, and that sense of wonder and awe at that. And now it's like a weekend trip, you know, there's rubbish and dead bodies and there's like a queue of people to get to the top to have their photograph taken. I mean, that's like somehow we've killed her.
Yeah.
We've killed her magnificence. You know, people doing Ironman and triathlons, and, you know, it's like, what can't we do? How many, you know, we can climb that and swim this, and we can suffer minus 25 and plus 100. And, you know, the awesomeness of nature, as we have become this Homo Deus, identified ourselves as godlike, we've conquered everything. And in the process of doing that, we've killed something really precious and accept death. And that's why having funerals is, it's a double. I get it. I know we're all sick of it. We've had a year of death and we're all sick of it and we just can't face it. But there is something about this is one thing we have not conquered.
That's the one thing that gives me hope. We are having a damn good go because there's a lot of,
We are.
People, you know, investing, I mean, billions and billions and billions.
Yeah, AI, transhumanism, whatever it is, we're trying. Can we download the brain so that we live forever, whatever?
We will always die. We may be kept alive on a machine, but you turn the machine off, you're done.
Yeah.
And I that's the one thing that gives me hope.
Yes, me too, because it's the only thing that's putting us in our place. You know, really is death. And then we have, you know, this kind of way of shoveling it away. And I know we want to shovel it away right now. I mean, we both feel it. You know, I really do see this as that as a paradox point. And we're on it because Saturn and Jupiter, this great 800 year conjunction is a perfect metaphor for this expand. You know, the moment when expansion meets contraction, the turn of the tide.
I've lived my life. I'm really fortunate. Yeah. It's very different matter for younger people, and especially for kids. Yeah. At some point, Gaia is just going to come, turn around and just wallop us right across the face. And we will be left reeling and unable to cope with it because we don't have the resilience inside ourselves.
Yeah.
Something to be greater than us.
Yes. So this is a time for that resilience building. Yeah. It is a time to kind of just say, okay, rather than what I want and what freedoms am I fighting for, it's what can I do without? How can I do with less? What actually can I be served with internally, spiritually, musically, artistically? We cannot lose that sense of connection to an inner space in which really there are many planes to be journeyed within. You know, it's a time for retreat and reflection, and not about just saying, I want to go and do this and I want to fly here and I need my holiday. You know, it would be sad if that's all it boiled down to, is just to fight yet again for me and what I want.
I don't think it will, because I think the genie's out of the bottle. I don't I don't even think we understand what this genie is.
No, I don't think we do.
But I do think there is a massive wake up in consciousness of people going, I do not want to go back to what it was, but I don't know what it is that I do want.
That's right. Yeah.
And you know, this sense of, because I've spoken to a lot of people saying, oh, I'm going to go off and live in the middle of nowhere and going to do my vegetables. And I mean, if you can find a piece of land and a house of four.
Yeah, and a price you can pay for
it. And also, have you tried actually digging the land? It's hard work. That's why young people used to do it in the old days. You know, and there's a sense of romanticism.
Yes.
About rural living.
Yes.
That really, having done it myself, and I've also lived on a narrow boat, it is not romantic. It's very hard work. And I think we're fed these romantic dreams, and we've got to work through that as well. William Meader calls it the glamour.
Yeah, I think it's true. I think we do. I like, we can romanticize the era that we've lost that was all so lovely and nostalgic. We do that all the time, whether it's the romantics, whether it's now about the empire. There's this sense of it was all great back then. But actually, people were making innovations to make our lives easier, and we have to make this work together in a community, in a city. You know, we make room for nature. I mean, I'm having this row on Facebook at the moment with my village because I've put a thing on saying, do we have to keep mowing the verges? Can we just let the verges grow? Oh, my dear God. I've been doing this for 30 years and I, you know, it's like my thing in life is to mow this verge. And, you know, it's just all kicked off. But that's an important thing to do on a micro level, you know, is to just say, make space for nature, stop controlling everything all the time. It's in the middle of the country. Why are we mowing verges in the middle of the country?
You know? I mean, you know, having said all of this, gosh, I'm grateful for what I have and to live the way I do, because, you know, I'm not ready for a mud hut.
No, we don't
corrugated roof.
No, but we'll move forwards. The thing, it's not about going back to a mud hut. It might be going to a solar panel built by a machine, paper, cardboard, fantastic space. There are so many ideas out there and so many innovations that can be made built on what we know.
I did see this wonderful, it's in Holland. They're making things from Rank Xerox machines. And they've made this house in 5 days. And it was wonderful. It was a proper lived-in house. And it was a bit weird to look at. But it came out of a machine.
Yeah.
It's like you can make cars now.
It's that 3D thing, isn't it? That 3D machine thing that they're making, like body parts.
They're making body parts.
Yeah.
I cannot get my head around that. Maybe because I haven't been brought up with that. The kids,
of course they
all understand that. That's going to be their life.
So I think that, you know, it's like Kem, he says in Your Children Are Not Your Children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but they're not from you.
Yeah.
You know, we need to be learning from them. We need to say, okay, you know, the ego, the kind of Gen X boomer ego has got to go. It's got to be put away in the box. Yeah. You know, we think we're it because we had the 60s or something. Yeah. You know, we've got it all sorted out. No. Actually, we need to be sitting back and paying attention because there's a lot of really good stuff coming from young people.
Well, I think they're so different from us. They seem not to have to be doing what we had to do, which was plow through the emotional glue. They don't have to do that kind of work. They're just on it like a bonnet. And I really enjoy that. And I enjoy that whole process of being an older woman amongst that to actually support them and to also be astonished by what they know.
Yeah, I think there's always that time when you sort of sit back and just say, you know, I've had my time. That again is about accepting mortality, accepting the letting go.
As you say, we're just at the beginning of this journey. I'm going to be very interested in how it impacts our whole relationship with life and death and our whole relationship with mortality and what life means to us.
That's the thing, is it's about making meaning from things. And of course, as I've said, and I will say to the end of time, I think that these places to connect to a sense of meaning, a sense of truth, a sense of greater truth, whether you call it religion, spirituality, art, or music, or ritual, we really need to keep that in our lives. And I feel that we are bereft in that area. And this is playing out as I see it in my job.
Yeah.
In my job, I see opportunities to connect to that part of ourselves that's better and greater and good. These are being taken away. And these are the freedoms that I'm worried about. These are the freedoms that we need to keep.
That was Angela Ward. For more information about her work, please go to angelaward.net. My next guest is Michelle Smith, a hospice director of clinical services who led her teams through the first waves of the pandemic. She is now offering training for emotional support as part of wellbeing initiatives within businesses and organisations.
Empathy is very much about walking alongside that person, not trying to fix it, not trying to make it better in any way. You're just allowing someone the space to explore how they're feeling, if they want to.
You've been listening to Embracing Your Mortality, and I look forward to you joining me again next time. In the meantime, here's to us all living more consciously for a better world.
The Embracing Your Mortality podcast was researched and recorded by Sue Brain and produced and edited by The Podcast Den.